promote international cooperation for a better application of the jurisdiction's domestic tax laws while respecting fundamental rights of the taxpayers. Now, the experts are here to take us through this briefing, and you can instruct who will lead us, Mr. Vandermeulen, but introduce your team to us.
Thank you very much, Chair. The Treasury will start off with the with their briefing. So if I could just ask the redundant to introduce his team.
Let me just get clarity on the members. You must have two documents in front of you. Do you have them?
Yes.
Okay. You may start.
Thank you, Chair. From the National Treasury South, I'm with my colleague Vanessa Chambokam. Our presentation this afternoon only be limited to tax treaty protocol with Oman and double tax agreement with Mauritius. We don't get involved much in the exchange of information protocols. We only get involved in the decision stage. That is an agreement between two relevant administrations. Thank you, Chair. I'll start with the treaty protocol with Oman. This is one of the tax treaty protocols that had to be negotiated before we switched off from secondary tax on companies to dividend tax. It is one of the last protocols that we're still awaiting ratification. The reason why it was negotiated is that we had in the old double tax agreement with Malta, we had a zero rate on dividend tax. And therefore, if we left it as it is, there would be a big gap for tax avoidance. Well, taxpayers will simply route their dividends via Malta, I mean via Oman, and will not get our fair share of revenue. And that is all, Chair, with regards to our presentation on Oman. Just very short, we'll only relate to one article, the dividend tax article. With your permission, I can move on to Mauritius DDA. Thank you, Chair. The DDA with Mauritius first came into force in 1997. It was negotiated when we were still on the SOC system. We didn't have a capital gains tax. And when we moved to the source, to the resident system, and we introduced capital gains tax, introduced dividend tax, introduced withholding tax on interest, it had to be renegotiated because at the time when it was negotiated, the two countries agreed to have zero rates on dividends, on interest, and on royalties, and they. CGT capital gains article only allows a country of residence to tax. Now, when we introduced the withholding taxes, we had a big problem because some taxpayers used the treaty and abused the tax treaty between South Africa and Mauritius through setting up things like intermediary holding companies. For example, if a company wanted to invest in, say, India, they would use the treaty with Mauritius instead of investing directly to India or any other country, not limited to India. And that gave rise to a lot of problems. So we're losing a lot of revenue. And from a policy perspective, we always want to encourage foreign direct investment, not investment to another country, especially if the country is a low tax jurisdiction. The renegotiation took place in 2010, was finalized in 2011. The agreement was signed this year on 17 May. key policy issues that we focused on, as indicated, were dividends, interest, royalties, capital gains tax, and exchange of information, which is very important because when a taxpayer hides his money in another country, if you don't have a good exchange of information article, then you won't be able to gather the information. But I'm not going to go into details on that. Ron, when he explains article by article, he will explain the implications of exchange of information. But just by way of example, the treaty before it was renegotiated, if a South African subsidiary and an income of 100 rand, as an example, it would pay corporate tax in South Africa of 28%, that would be 28 rand. The domestic dividend rate without the treaty would be 15%, but with the treaty, the treaty will reduce it to 5% or 10%, depending on the shareholding. For example, if the company holds 25% shares, it would pay a rate of 5%. If it holds less than that, then pay 10%. The reason for that is we want to encourage substantial shareholding in the company. But after the treaty was negotiated, we decided, due to the outflows or outbound dividends going to Mauritius, to increase the amount of dividend tax rate to 10% if a company holds 10% shares in a company. And that is also in line with international trends. With regards to interest, we also saw a lot of offshore cycle scheme where you have a South African company that would claim interest deduction in South Africa. The money goes offshore, it's not taxed in Mauritius, because Mauritius doesn't have a withholding tax on interest. And it comes back to South Africa in the form of dividends. Because we have what is called a participation exemption, where if you hold more than 10% equity shares in a foreign company, or voting rights in a foreign company, you bring the dividends back tax-free. The reason for that was that we wanted people to bring their money back. If they invest offshore, and they want to bring their money back, and you tax them, they won't bring their money back, they'll keep it offshore. So in order to encourage them to bring their money back, we allowed what we call the participation exemption. However, that was used to avoid self-claim tax, where people would claim a deduction here, and it goes offshore, it's not tax, it comes back, it's not tax. And that was loss of revenue to the fiscal. Currently, after the treaty was negotiated, we also agreed with our Mauritian colleagues that we'd impose a 10% interest withholding tax. The next one is with royalties. Royalties, again, it is the same issue without repeating myself. And in the old treaty, it had a zero, withholding tax. Now we agreed that would have a 5% rate on royalties. The reason for a lower rate on royalties was that we weren't seeing a lot of abuse there. So there was no need to have a higher rate. But at the same time, as much as we want to prevent tax abuse, we also don't want to be an impediment to business. We want people to invest their money and bring their money back. We had what, in the old treaty, you had what is called a tax bearing. A tax bearing is where you say, if Mauritius doesn't tax or exempt income, as South Africa will also treat that let me repeat that. If you pay tax in Mauritius, we give you credit in South Africa for the taxes that you pay in Mauritius. But if Mauritius doesn't have a tax or it exempts that income, in South Africa we still give you a tax bearing. Treat that income as if you had paid tax on it. Now, that was used by taxpayers to, again, erode our tax base, and we're losing a lot of revenue. And in the new treaty, we agreed that we will get rid of that tax barring article. As indicated in the earlier stage in our introduction, we, in the current or the old tax treaty, we didn't have, if you hold shares in a property rich company, Mauritians have a right to tax. If the shares were held by Mauritian residents, but the property rich company was in South Africa, when the Mauritian resident disposes of the shares in the property rich company, Mauritians would have a right to tax. But Mauritians doesn't have capital gains tax. So that was subject to a lot of abuse, because some South Africans would change their residence from South Africa to Mauritius while they still have movable property in South Africa, or while they still hold shares in the property rich company and dispose of their shares in property rich companies while they're in Mauritius, and they won't be subject to any tax. And South Africa lost a lot of money on that. Now, in the new agreement, we have agreed that the country of source, that is South Africa, will have a right to tax capital gains on the property rich company when the foreign resident and Mauritian resident disposes of the shares in the property rich company. Chair, that concludes my presentation. I'll leave the exchange of information to my colleague.
Changed protocols that we've entered into.
reduction of dividends tax. That's all on Amman, Chair. Shall I go straight to the region? Once again, I think my colleague from Treasury has pointed out some of the issues that led us to renegotiate the double taxation agreement with Mauritius. I'd like to highlight some of the more important changes which arise in that particular new DTA. And the first one is in Article 4 on residence. The definition of resident. Now that's important because the people who are allowed to use this treaty are people who are residents of either state, in other words, resident either of South Africa or of Mauritius. However, because of the conflict of tax systems, it can often arise that an individual or even a company can be a resident in more than one state. And therefore, in Article 4, which defines a resident, you have what we call a tiebreaker rule, because you have to then decide which state has the sole right to claim that individual or company as his resident. So the tiebreaker rule for companies has traditionally referred to place of effective management, but that is an issue which in international taxation creates some problems at least. So we're using a revised version of that tiebreaker rule, which in fact derives from alternate commentary in both the OECD and the United Nations model treaties. And it provides that if a person other than an individual is a resident of both states, the competent authorities of the contracting state shall by mutual agreement settle the question and determine the mode of application of the agreement to such person. If we cannot agree, Chair, such person shall be considered to be outside the scope of the agreement, except for the provisions of Article 25, Exchange of Information. Now, the commentaries give a full description of exactly what issues will be looked at in coming to that mutual agreement between the two states. It's not a new approach by South Africa. We have it in a number of our newer treaties because we think it's better to look at the whole picture than simply to look at one simple issue such as place of effective management. Moving then to Article 5, Chair. This deals with permanent establishment. This article is also a definition that defines what permanent establishment is, and in particular it sets certain time limits. And those time limits act as a threshold, and if you look at the fact that a double tax agreement is supposed to take away barriers to cross-border trade and investment, we say that a resident of one state won't be taxed in the other state until he's crossed a threshold, and in terms of business profit, that threshold is called permanent establishment. In relation to construction, the international models say that there won't be a permanent establishment for 12 months in respect of OECD or 6 months in respect of the United Nations. In respect of the South Africa Mauritius DTA, building site construction, installation or assembly project or any supervisory activity in connection with that site or project has to be engaged in for more than 12 months before a PE exists. Secondly, we look at the furnishing of services by an enterprise through its employees. And then we say that the presence of the employees providing those services in the other state should be for a period exceeding 183 days in any 12-month period before a permanent establishment is deemed to exist. And then further on, that provision deals with employees of an enterprise. The next one deals with the performance of professional services or other activities of an independent character by an individual, and the threshold there is exactly the same, 183 days in any 12-month period, and then you have a permanent establishment. Turning to Article 8, Chair, profits of an enterprise from the operation of ships or aircraft in international traffic shall be taxable only in the resident state. And that's absolutely standard in all South Africa's double tax agreements, and in fact is the preferred international approach. With regard to Article 10, dividends, it's once again 5% where the shareholding in that state is at least, in the company, sorry, is at least 10%. And 10% on portfolio investment. Foreign direct, 5%, portfolio, 10%. Interest, as pointed out by my colleague, it's now 10%, max tax in the source state. And we have some exemptions for interest going out from the source state, and that's in respect of interest received or paid by the state itself. Or its wholly owned institutions, and for debt instruments which are listed on recognized stock exchanges. And all we've done here is to put out the exemptions which we currently have in our domestic law and built it into the treaty. So there's no difference between domestic law and the treaty in relation to those exemptions. And paragraph 4 notes that the recognized stock exchanges are for South Africa the JSE, and for Mauritius the Stock Exchange of Mauritius. Royalties, as pointed out by my colleague, 5% in all cases. In the source state, that's the limit on the withholding tax. Pensions and annuities, we brought in a provision in the article dealing with pensions and annuities, which says that if the payments are made under a social security system, then under social security legislation of a state, they're taxable only the state which pays that pension, and therefore we follow the principle that the state pays, it has the sole right of taxation. We have the Article 20 on professors and teachers. They exempt from taxation in the state they're visiting for a period of 2 years if the payment is received from outside the host state. So as an example, if a professor from South Africa should go to teach in Mauritius, he would be exempt in Mauritius for a period of 2 years, provided the payment of his salary came from South Africa, and of course vice versa. That would mean they're still liable to tax in their normal state of residence, but not in the state being visited, and that's merely to encourage this movement of skill cross border. Exchange of information, Chair, and I'm going to say this probably another 30 times this afternoon. What we've done here is to bring this in line with the absolute latest in international models, and that basically ensures that no state can use bank secrecy or the absence of a domestic tax interest to deny a request for exchange of information. And as you would expect, Chair, that's fairly important in relation to our relationship with Mauritius. We also then have Article 26, which deals with assistance in the collection of taxes, and under this article the two states are empowered to collect taxes on behalf of each other. The bottom line there, Chair, is that once an assessment has become absolute final in one state, no more possibility of court challenges, it's gone through the whole process, final, it's collectible. If that person is resident in the other state, has no assets in your state, you can ask the other state then to collect that tax on your behalf, and he would do so under his domestic law, vice versa. It works on reciprocity. Finally, in the protocol, paragraph 1 provides for most favoured nation provision with respect to Article 10, subparagraphs 2A and B. The Mauritians asked that this provision be brought into the treaty so that if we entered into an agreement with a third state which provided for more favourable rates in the future, we would go back to Mauritius and negotiate those particular rates again. And then finally, with reference to Article 23, the non-discrimination provision, paragraph 5, there's a provision which says that if South Africa abolishes the secondary tax on companies, paragraph 5 in non-discrimination would fall away. Its provisions would cease to to have effect. As you know, Chair, we have in fact abolished SDC, so paragraph 5 will in future have no effect in this treaty. And that's our comments on Mauritius.
All the members, you've got it. Agreement, Mauritius and Oman. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to come back to the agreement between South Africa and I think it was Mauritius. That long gap, I think from 97 to now, 2013, I think. What is the reason for that long gap where there are no updates on the agreement?
I think the issue there, Chair, is that...
And then it's so interesting, I would like to know if there are any certain guidelines, when I hear this country to country, are there any certain guidelines that place a foundation as to what are the principles of these agreements? And if I hear you correctly, this is about people operating within the legal framework of the law. This is not people that are doing other cross-border activities illegally. And are you then called in if, I think I had to explain something to that effect, are you then called in to assist with the correct taxation that individuals or companies must pay if they are called? Thank you.
Well, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The National Treasury, you're saying that this is to plug losses to fiscus, to tax. Can you quantify that? How much have we lost on an annual basis before these changes? We're spending a lot of time and money to redo these protocols. Exactly what's the benefit in terms of real success?
Chair, actually I asked the question to understand the most favored nation. If I could just get that explanation, and of course, the other thing is to expand to the question of Honorable Joseph. You know, is whether at the level of the AU, whether there are anything that's happening in terms of this kind of relationship, and if they are there, and then what sort of incorporation, integration, or anything that seeks to make us to work toward the same systems. And of course, is that in terms of the previous protocol, as it was, do you know whether how much have we received from Mauritius through this particular protocol? And whether we just simply approving this protocol, but what comes from that particular country is not significant. Just to check whether there's anything that comes from this room.
You can reply.
Thank you, Chair. I'll leave the cost benefit to my colleague, if I may. The first question dealt with the fact that the previous treaty operated from 97. It was in fact operational, the old South Africa-Mauritius Treaty, and it operated from 97. Well, it's still operational right now. The new treaty will only come into effect once approved by both houses here. I think the main issue why we had such a different approach in the two treaties was, as my colleague Lutando pointed out earlier, when we negotiated this treaty in the 90s, we had a source system of taxation, and therefore our approach to cross-border taxation was somewhat different to now, when we tax on the basis of residence. So we've always had a treaty with Mauritius from 97 through to now. This is a modernization, it's an update, it includes better international practice, and as my colleague pointed out, closes loopholes. That's really hard to quantify, but I won't say anything further on that. If I could just jump to the MFN clause, Chair. It's a most favoured nation clause, and it's often used in treaties where you want to ensure that whatever you've negotiated in a treaty won't be put you in a worse position when that country negotiates in future. So Mauritius said, okay, we agreed to 5%, 10% for royalties, but if in future you go and negotiate, say, 2% and 3% with somebody else, can you please come back to us so we can renegotiate on a bilateral level? And that's the rationale behind the most favoured nation clause. South Africa, in fact, uses it in a number of treaties to ensure that when we negotiate with another country, that if they negotiate lower rates in future, they should also give us the opportunity to try and get that better treatment. And then there was a really interesting question which focused on SADC and also the African Union with regard to guidelines. SADC has a tax subcommittee, and it does have a model, double taxation agreement, which for the most part we follow in most of our in all of our negotiations. It puts forward a consensus position of SADC member states with reservations. It's just a model, Chair. It doesn't have any legal status, excuse me, other than the fact that it's approved by ministers as being just a model which shows the approach of Southern African states. But states are free, of course, to reserve positions and say we prefer to use a different approach. And of course, when it comes to a negotiation, you can't always get 100% of what you ask. So, from a SADC point of view, very much so. From an AU point of view, there's been very little done, Chair, in terms of tax cooperation as such. However, there is ATAF, which is the African Tax Administration Forum, which now has 36 African member states as members. And we're following the same path at this stage with ATAS, where we put forward a model treaty to the member states to have a look at and follow the same kind of approach that SADC has. And well, it's virtually identical to what SADC promotes as being the best approach of the region, and therefore, if accepted by ATAS, it'll have an African approach of 36 states, which is pretty good. With regard to the cross-border cooperation, there's an article in every treaty, which is the mutual agreement procedure, which allows the states to deal with issues of interpretation affecting both their taxpayers and interpretation of the states themselves when applying those treaties. So that if a taxpayer feels that he's been hard done by, wrongly assessed, he can take it up with the tax authority of the state in which he's a resident, and that tax authority takes it up with the tax authority in the other state, and between them, they have a mutual agreement procedure to decide what the correct method of assessment should be. In terms of exchange of information, it's exactly that exchange of information which allows us to get a grip more on people operating outside the treaties, because without the information, well, you can't do much. But if you have the information, you have at least the opportunity of applying the full force of your domestic law. And now I'll hand to my colleague.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the figures, we don't have figures right in front of me at the moment, but at the top of my head, and one of the issues that made us to want to renegotiate this treaty was that outbound investments going to Mauritius were much, much, much higher than inbound investment coming to South Africa. We get the figures from the Reserve Bank, and we only get them a year later. But the 2011 outbound investments to Mauritius were about 58 billion rand, and inbound coming from Mauritius to South Africa was about 5-6 billion rand. That was a huge concern to us, and I mean, as you are aware, Mauritius does not have natural resources. There's not much happening there in terms of substance. I think their main revenue raiser is tax and tourism. That was a concern, and these figures grew every year. For example, 2010 outbound investments to Mauritius were about 52 billion, so they grew by about 6 billion. And if you compare that with other countries where the natural resources, where you have mines, you have other substantial activities happening, they didn't grow by this much. And we also saw a trend of South African companies setting up intermediary holding companies in Mauritius. So every financial institution, for example, has an intermediary holding company in Mauritius. So they use the intermediary holding companies to then transfer money to other countries or to hold investments in other countries. For example, if you a company would set up an intermediary holding company to hold its subsidiaries in Africa and in Asia. Because we didn't have tax, if dividends went to Mauritius, we're not subject to any tax. So there's a zero rate on dividends article. We have a zero rate on interest article. We have a zero rate on royalties in the old treaty. And we didn't have CGT on property rich companies. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Just a point of clarity. I would like to know if these treaties are open-ended, or is it last for 5 or 10 years and then lapse, or is it just ongoing up to a point as and when required to amend and update the treaties. So my question is there a time frame attached to this or not?
Yeah, Chair. I just wanted to check because when it comes to these percentages of interest and dividends, it looks like the motivation at some point was to encourage people to return the investments or the revenue or whatever back to the country. Now, I just wanted to know, how does that, on a practical level, compare to a normal resident who's doing business the same way but doing it inside the country? Are they comparable in terms of their tax obligations, whether they have to actually to pay for their taxes to SARS, or is it posing a better conditions from the one that does it in Mauritius, but then have it either unchecked coming back and then be of in a better position as compared to somebody who's doing business inside the country? What is the comparison? And I just hope that the chair on the lighter note, the most favored nation is not a collusion. Thanks.
It's not the what? Yeah, Mr. Bobo, Mr. for the matter.
Thank you, Chair. First question, no, there's no time frame. Traditionally, all double taxation agreements are not set for a particular period of years. They will operate and they will be changed as economic relationships between the two states change, or there are major changes in tax systems which would require an amendment of that treaty. I'm going to ask my colleague to answer the second part, but I'd just like to start that by saying the double taxation agreements are there to create benefits in order to encourage
foreigners to invest in your country, and therefore you need to create for those people a favourable destination for investment. And in that respect, if you don't follow international practice, you find that they will invest somewhere else where those particular guidelines are followed. So it's a delicate issue, but every country with double taxation agreements follows a pattern of creating a favourable regime for foreign residents to invest in their country as a matter of incentive. So, Tanda.
Thank you, Chair. The comparison is not favourable to South African residents. South African residents, for example, will be subject to a dividend tax of 15%, at the rate of 15%, while non-residents, if there is a treaty, will obviously reduce that to 10%, sometimes 5%. As Ron indicated, the reason for that is more to encourage foreign investors to invest in South Africa. And again, also, it's also part of our Gateway to Africa strategy, because, as you may be aware, most international companies that invest in Africa have their head offices in South Africa. And you want to encourage them to do that, to continue doing that, otherwise lose out on other jurisdictions if your rates of withholding taxes are high. And that's basically the reason why you have disparities in terms of withholding taxes. Because if a foreign investor wants to invest, for example, they have their head offices in South Africa, and they also want to invest in Botswana, in Zimbabwe, in Zambia, through South Africa, and if you impose a high withholding tax, then they'll consider other jurisdictions that have lower withholding tax rate. And we also have our multinationals who invest in African countries and Asian countries as well. If you impose higher withholding taxes as well, they won't bring their money back. They'll keep their money offshore. And you will also lose out on that revenue. Thank you.
If I could just add one thing, too. We have to always remember that this is bilateral. So it also favours our taxpayers, as my colleagues pointed out. And the less tax they pay in the other jurisdiction, the less credit we have to give them against South African tax. So it's a reciprocal thing, and it cuts both ways, and I think that's important.
I wonder whether we've got time, Chair, for this debate.
You've got time until 5 o'clock.
Yeah. The Chair, you see why I'm raising this particular matter is because, you know, is that if we continue to do this, I'm not saying that we should stop, then we may find ourselves creating a situation where our own will not invest inside because it is costly, and invest in an outside country, and then those out there then come here because all of them then they operate on a 10% whatever. You know, it's we may find ourselves creating a situation which is a will. Those that are here then they find it favorable in Mauritius, and those in Mauritius find it favorable at the tax level. And then, I don't know, it will be a vicious cycle one of these good days. Because, I mean, if for, say, what's Tokyo's company, this one of the mine, if it feels that doing business in South Africa, then you are actually putting them on 15%, then, but if they do it in DRC Congo or in Mauritius, then they can save 5%, and then they'll probably then go there. And then those there as well will feel that now they can only be liable for 15% here. And then they may not do it in Mauritius and come here. And I mean, I'm not saying this, you're looking on one side to entice people to come. But it has got a reverse side that says local investors, then it is costly for you to do it at home. Then look outside the border. So I don't know. I'm just raising it as a debate of actually looking on both sides of the conflict.
get that picture, but not today.
And can I make just one comment on that, Chair, if I may? I think we have to remember that if a South African resident invests outside, that doesn't mean he's not subject to South African tax. And the fact that the treaty would reduce his tax burden in the other state simply means that when we subject him to tax here, we give a lower credit. So in fact, it's beneficial for South Africa.
Yes. Anything else? So we've done with Mauritius and Oman. Where's Oman? He's in reports that we adopted. Members, do you want to do every report separately, or can we take it at the end? At the end. Brilliant. You are on the floor again with the next presentation. It's about the Republic of Botswana, South Africa, and
This is Botswana, Chair.
Yeah, well, take the lead. You can take us through.
Okay, this is only about exchange of information, so our colleagues at Treasury, as pointed out, this is an issue between the tax authorities of the two governments in dealing with exchange of information. And I guess I don't have to say that the whole question of exchange of information, transparency, has become one of the major issues in international taxation, so that virtually all the countries are now trying to ensure that there's a far better and fuller exchange of information in order that the domestic law could be applied properly. So the only change to the convention between South Africa and Botswana, which has been operational now for about 7 or 8 years, was the article on exchange of information, where we deleted the old article, excuse me, Chair, and brought it in line now with both the OECD and United Nations models, so that it extends to exchanges of information in respect of taxes of every kind and description, and it ensures that bank secrecy or the absence of a domestic tax interest can no longer be used to deny a request for exchange of information. Full exchanges are authorised, and that includes automatic exchange of information. That was the only change to that convention, so it's a very short protocol which amends only that article, Chair. Chair, the next is South Africa signed the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters as amended by the 2011 protocol. And this was the one that we did a presentation at our last appearance at your committee, sir. Unfortunately, it hadn't been referred properly, so I guess you want me to do it again. We covered it at the last meeting, but you were not able to take a decision because it had, there was some problem in the referral from National Assembly to you.
We've got the challenge referring to the FIROX coming from the NA to the NCP. It's quite a challenge. Generously quick.
Certainly. The purpose of this convention is to allow, of course, for effective exchange of information and administrative assistance between tax authorities of the states which are party to the convention. At this stage, more than 50 countries have signed this convention. And the range of member states, of states which have signed this convention stretch across South America, North America, Europe, Africa, the Far East, Australia, wherever. But more than 50 states have now signed up to this. And importantly, there are a number of states which have signed this convention with which South Africa doesn't have a comprehensive double taxation agreement. So So we don't have any exchange of information with those countries because of limited trade, economic relations. There's no need for us to have a double taxation agreement, but we do want exchange of information because some of those countries are countries which are low tax jurisdictions. So therefore it's important. If I could then move to the actual articles of that Mutual Assistance Convention. Article 1 says the object of the convention and the persons covered to allow for administrative assistance, which comprises exchange of information, and it includes simultaneous tax examinations and participation in tax examinations abroad. It includes assistance in the recovery of taxes. It includes the service of documents, although South Africa will reserve its position in relation to service of documents. And assistance is to be provided whether the person affected is a resident or national of a party or of any other state. Article 2, taxes covered, once again, it applies to the widest possible range of taxes imposed by the parties. Chair, you'll see at the end, when we put our instrument of ratification in, we reserve our position on some of the taxes which we consider not to be necessary in relation to South Africa's participation to this convention, and that goes for all the other member states as well. If I can move then to Article 4, exchange of information. This is the general provision allowing for exchange of information foreseeably relevant to the enforcement of the domestic laws of the party concerning taxes covered by the convention, and it follows more or less the international models which outlaw bank secrecy, domestic interest, etc. Article 5 deals with exchange of information on request. And there is the traditional one which we already cover in many of our tax information exchange agreements, where you actually only get this information when you request it. If the information is available in the tax files of the requested state, is not sufficient to enable it to comply with the request for information, that other state is obliged to take all relevant measures to provide the applicant state with the information requested. So they use their own domestic law to get the information which you require. Exchange of information under Article 6 says they may exchange information automatically. And Chair, that's the future. That is the future. The request is, I think, the first step towards transparency. Automatic exchange is the future. Article 7, spontaneous exchange of information. An example of that is if you're doing an audit, you see that there's information here which, for argument's sake, would be of interest to one of the other signatory states to this convention, you should give them that information without them having requested it. And it might not be on an automatic system so that it would otherwise fall through the cracks. Article 8 deals with simultaneous tax examinations. At the request of one of them, two or more parties shall consult together for the purposes of determining cases and procedures for simultaneous tax examination. Each party involved shall decide whether or not it wishes to participate. And this is really important, and this is something that we're actually looking at also in terms of the African Tax Administration Forum, in that when a multinational operates in say four or five or six African states, to do a proper audit, you would need all five of those states really to sit around the table and conduct that simultaneous tax examination. You can only do that if you have a legal basis to exchange that information, and it's provided by this particular article. Tax examinations abroad, at the request of the competent authority of the applicant state, the requested state may allow representatives to be present at an appropriate part of a tax examination in the requested state. All decisions with respect to the conduct of the tax examination, of course, shall be made by the requested state in terms of its domestic law. A party may inform the depositories of its intention not to accept such requests. South Africa would do that in terms Article 11 deals with assistance in recovery, the recovery of tax claims. It follows very much what we've just dealt with in the Mauritius Treaty, where assessments are final. Taxpayers in the other country, they would use the force of their law to collect that tax debt on your behalf. Also, measures of conservancy where assessment is not yet final, but you have a fear that they're going to move the money somewhere, you can ask the state where the assets are to take measures of conservancy to protect your rights. Article 17, service of documents. This is where we will be having a reservation. Our reservation would be simply that we will not do service of documents on behalf of another state. They're welcome to use our postal system, but if they want to serve summonses, etc., there are not mutual legal assistance treaties which countries use in respect of legal issues like that, and we don't want to be involved in that. Finally, Article 21, protection of persons and limits to the obligation to provide assistance. You're not obliged to provide assistance where it involves carrying out measures at variance with its own laws or administrative practices, to carry out measures which would be contrary to public policy, to supply information not obtainable under its own law or its administrative practice, to supply information which would disclose any trade, business, commercial or professional secret or trade process, information the disclosure of which would be contrary to public policy, B, to provide administrative assistance insofar as it considers the taxation in the applicant state does not follow international norms, or finally to provide administrative assistance for the purpose of administering or forcing or enforcing a provision of a tax law which in fact discriminates against a national of your own state. So if they have a tax law which discriminates against South African nationals and asked us for information, clearly we would not be obliged to meet that request. To provide administrative assistance if the applicant state has not pursued all reasonable measures in its own territory, and finally to provide administrative assistance in recovery where the administrative burden for that state is disproportionate to the benefit derived by the applicant state. If that state asks you to collect 10,000 rand of tax and it's going to cost you 100,000, well, figures don't add, Chair. Bank secrecy, again, it's made very clear that bank secrecy or the absence of a domestic tax interest may not be used by any state to deny a request for exchange of information. Article 22 deals with secrecy, confidentiality. It says that confidentiality of any information exchanged or received will be applied according to the domestic law of the state. Costs, ordinary costs incurred in providing assistance shall be borne by the requested state. If there's extraordinary costs, well then the two states have to decide how to deal with that. And normally the applicant state, as set out here, should be liable to bear those costs. So for argument's sake, if you had to go and employ an advocate and go to court in order to get information or to collect a tax debt, that would be an extraordinary cost, and therefore the applicant state should bear the cost of that. Other international agreements or arrangements under Article 27, the assistance provided by this convention does not limit, nor is it limited by any other agreement which allows for similar assistance. And then finally, Article 30 on reservations. In accordance with paragraph 1A to F of Article 30, a state may enter into reservations relating to taxes covered, tax claims, service of documents, and the entry into force state for intentional conduct liable to prosecution under criminal laws. And that will come up in the slides following, where South Africa, in terms of its instrument of ratification, will in fact have some reservations. States also must enter into declarations in terms of Annex A with respect to taxes covered, Annex B with regard to who the competent authority is under the treaty, Annex C applications will set out as follows, that in Annex A, taxes to which the convention would apply, you'll see in the next slide a full list of South Africa's taxes, the income tax, withholding tax on royalties, tax on foreign entertainers and sports persons, turnover tax on micro-businesses, secondary tax on companies but terminated as from 31 March 2012, dividend tax, withholding tax on interest. Capital gains, estate duty, donations tax, transfer duty, value-added tax, excise tax, and securities transfer tax. With regard to Annex B, competent authority is the Commissioner for the South African Revenue Service or an authorised representative of the Commissioner, and the declaration under Annex C of the term national is any individual possessing the nationality or citizenship of South Africa and any legal person, partnership, association or other entity deriving its status as such from the laws in force in South Africa, and that's our normal definition under all our double taxation agreements. The reservations that we would set out in this formal document is as follows. Firstly, we reserve our position on taxes on income, profits, capital gains or net wealth which are imposed on behalf of a political subdivision or local authority. We don't have that, so there's no reciprocity. Compulsory social security contributions payable to the general government or to social security institutions, again, not an issue for South Africa. Taxes on the use or ownership of motor vehicles, not an issue for South Africa. Taxes on the use or ownership of movable property, other than motor vehicles. Again, we tax that income arising from trade under income tax. We don't have separate taxes on the use or ownership of movable property. The next one, taxes in categories referred to in subparagraph 3, which is taxes in other categories except customs duties, above which are imposed on behalf, once again, of political subdivisions or local authorities of a party. And then finally, South Africa enters a reservation and will not provide assistance with regard to the service of documents as described in Article 17 of the Convention. This reservation will not apply to the service of documents as described in paragraph 3 of that article, and that's through the post. And as I said, in those instances, countries who wish to have documents served can use the mutual legal assistance treaties which South Africa has with those countries. Those are my comments, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Honourable. Members, questions, clarifications? Although Mashida and Joseph.
Chair, it's only that these things you are doing them in the speed of light, Chair. But one, I think, would have been very interested to know exactly that what is left, what is the value of entering into this, when you've got the whole range of reservations, and also given Chair, that these countries, we are not necessarily having the same laws. The spirit of the laws may be the same, but the manner in which they are crafted may be too different, and attaching certain secrecy or whatever to them. And on that basis, one can say, in terms of this particular convention, automatically, on the basis of our legislation that we are implementing in the different countries, there will be some percentage of non-compliance between the two countries. And then now there's a provision for reservations on things that you would not comply. And then now the question is, what is left of the convention that is then applicable? I think that's a typical evaluation that one would have loved to hear in terms terms of the protocol, then read through the reservations that you are putting in there, and also the laws that are not compliant or they are not the same, that create a contradiction. What is there that is left? And then the second question, Chair, I think that needs that I'll just need a little bit of clarification, is that where you can't assist an African state, is there any provision of a recourse to actually get that particular thing, like whether it's an application of a particular partner, to actually make sure that that particular African state can get that? Because I'm reading it like, under the normal circumstances, there are things that we can't perform. But is there a provision of a route of actually getting some sort of a recourse to get that particular information? Let's say it's a classified information, but in South Africa, like you have this other legislation that provides for you to get either classified information or that. In terms of this one, where you can't perform in the African state and then need the particular information, but then that information is either secret, it's classified, you cannot give it automatically. What then happens? Is it a closed book? Then the African state can't do anything. Then what is the, if that is the case, what is the need of this convention? That's it.
Thank you, Anna Bajay. Just a point of clarity in terms of the competent authority on page 24. My mind would say that the Minister of Finance or the Minister of International Relations is the competent authority and not the commissioner. And that authority will be delegated to a commissioner or another representative. I will not respect too low in terms of this is international agreements we are making, so why don't we use the commissioner to be the competent authority? I think it should be the minister. Or even the president, because it starts with the president normally when they have a meeting and then the ministers are, with your staff departments, putting these conventions and agreements in place. And then, of course, just as a question for interest on the borders, you know, and I do not want to brand Africa negatively, but there is a perception that you can't do business in Africa, you don't make a deal. You know, so where does the not the enforcement, but the management of all these conventions come in? Particularly now, if you're on the border, you wait for 5, 6, 7 hours, and those people have money, just go through. That's what we hear almost every day. What is our tax source and Home Affairs and whoever is busy at that border, what departments, what are we doing about getting that right in terms of the economy that exchange to between these borders? Because although it's people moving, with that is a huge economy attached to products that cross the borders for business banking.
That's an item for a joint oversight visit by Finance and Home Affairs. Yes. Any other questions?
Yeah. That's the second chair. The explanation that was given on the most preferred nations, chair, it was that if you have entered into this particular arrangement, if you negotiate a favorable with a third state, then this one then must also come to the same level. Now, what I want to know is, does the reverse also work? If you negotiate with the third one, but then you have got an unfavorable condition, do you have a reverse on this one, from favorable to an unfavorable, or it works one way only? What's the situation there?
Can you reply to these remarks, questions?
Thank you, Chair. If I could start with the MFN clause, the most favoured nation, it particularly looks at where we would negotiate a lower rate with a third state. If you look at the relationship between Mauritius and South Africa, clearly it's in their interest to have the lowest rates possible, and therefore they're not particularly interested if we negotiated higher rates with a third state. They're more interested if we give a better deal to a third state, in which case they would ask us, it wouldn't automatically be the case, but they would ask us to negotiate with them to see if they could get the same favourable rates. So I think if I could say that that is the MFN provision. I think we must be really careful when we start saying that the reservations have virtually killed the usefulness of this particular convention. Chief, if you look at the taxes that we've reserved on, there are taxes, firstly, that we don't impose in South Africa, so there's no need for us to get that kind of information from another state if we don't impose that tax ourselves. That being so, where we don't impose those taxes itself, we don't have that information to give to the other country. For argument's sake, we don't have a separate tax on movable assets. If you're using your movable assets in the course of your business and you're earning income from it, you're subject to income tax. We haven't reserved our position on income tax, so that is still very much in the treaty. And if you look at the covered taxes that we've already said that we will be exchanging information on, I think it's a very comprehensive list, which goes through income tax, royalties, foreign entertainers, micro businesses, SDC, dividend tax, interest, capital gains, state duty, donations tax, transfer duty, value-added tax, excise tax, and securities transfer tax. That's a considerable list, and that covers all of our taxes, and that's what we're interested in. What we've reserved on are things which are really of no consequence to South Africa, and therefore I don't think takes away from the viability and the need for that particular, for this convention. With regard to non-compliance and the fact that some countries might still have bank secrecy or whatever, and I understand that this would be a concern, it would be pointless to have an agreement with a country which then turns around and says, yes, I'm a party to this agreement, but there's bank secrecy and therefore I'm not going to give you the information. That is specifically outlawed under the treaty. And any country that is a signatory to this specifically commits to that they will exchange information regardless of bank secrecy, etc. So I think non-compliance, if you look at a membership of more than 50 countries worldwide, would create a serious issue for any signatory to this agreement who did not, in fact, meet the terms of its international obligations. With regard to classified information, we will exchange all information that SARS is legally able to get. And that would include everything which we are allowed to get under the terms of the Income Tax Act. There is, of course, an exception made in terms of public policy. So nobody could ask you to give away a state secret, as it were, because that would be contrary to public policy. So there are issues which are set out where there are exceptions to the obligation, where states would need to say, am I going to give this information? Is it against public policy? Is it, for argument's sake, giving away the trade secrets of a company? For argument's sake, you wouldn't say to Coca-Cola, I want your recipe of Coke. It ain't going to happen. That's not allowed. So, yes, there will be issues where information will not be exchanged for those reasons,
But by and large, this is a full and comprehensive exchange in relation to the taxes which we in fact impose and administer from day to day. If I could move then to the competent authority issue, Chair. It cannot be the Minister and it cannot be the President, because we are dealing with the information of taxpayers, and therefore it's covered by the confidentiality clauses of the income tax law, which is administered by the Commissioner. And therefore you'll see in all of our double taxation agreements, the competent authority is the Commissioner, because the responsibility of administering the Income Tax Act is placed on the Commissioner, not on the Minister. And therefore, it just has to be that way. The other one was the management of treaties. Yes, having crossed borders, I understand very much what you say. Unfortunately, this is not an agreement which would address those kind of issues. We are looking at one-stop border posts in relation to some of our borders, notably Mozambique, which will be in front of the committees very shortly, and that addresses issues of movement of people between the borders, as it should, of neighbouring states. This treaty ain't going to help that at all, because it's merely about exchange of information. What I can say is that our customs agreements will allow for exchange of information and technical assistance in relation to customs issues. So insofar as SARS is concerned, I would limit my comments to that, if I may, Chair.
Thank you. All the members, they've got the presentations. Can we deal with the reports, Mr. Baker? I put the following reports to the committee in terms of the briefing she just received. Report of the Select Committee on Finance on the agreement between the Government of the Republic of South Africa and the Government of the Republic of Mauritius for the avoidance of double taxation and the prevention of fiscal evasion with respect to taxes on income dated the 13th of August 2013. The Select Committee on Finance, having considered the request for approval by the Parliament of the agreement between the Government of the RSA and the Government of the Republic of Mauritius for the avoidance of double taxation and the prevention of fiscal evasion with respect to taxes on income tabled in terms of section 2312 of the Constitution 1996, approved the said agreement. I put this to the committee. Proposal? Honourable Sheila and seconder, Honourable Chairman. The second one. Regarding the agreement with the government of the Sultanate of Oman, the Select Committee on Finance, having considered the request for approval by Parliament of the supplementary protocol amending the agreement between the government of the Republic of South Africa and the government of the Sultanate of Oman for the avoidance of double taxation and the prevention of fiscal evasion with respect to taxes on income tabled in terms of section 2312 of the Constitution 1996, approved the said supplementary protocol. I put the report to the committee. Proposal? Honorable Faku, and seconded by Honorable Joseph. The one month with the agreement with Botswana, the Select Committee on Finance, having considered the request for the approval by Parliament of the protocol amending the convention between the Government of the Republic of South Africa and the Government of the Republic of Botswana for the avoidance of double taxation and the prevention of fiscal evasion with respect to taxes on income and protocol tabled in terms of section 2312 of the Constitution 1996, approved the said protocol. Honourable members, proposing and seconded, please. Honourable Machida proposes, Honourable Joseph seconds. The last one, the Select Committee on Finance, having considered the request for approval by Parliament of the Convention on Mutual Administrative assistance in tax matters as amended by the 2011 protocol tabled in terms of section 2312 of the Constitution 1996 approved the said convention. Honourable members, a proposal for this adoption. Honourable Charlie proposed and Honourable Joseph seconds. Honourable members, that brings us to the end of the business.
Just before, sir. Just simply to raise the questions that we have raised. One, just understand that the officials have got some of them. And we need a little bit of attention to them. We're not just simply raising them for the sake of raising them. It's unfortunate that there is nothing that we can do in changing the problem. We can't change. But when you come back, I mean, so some little bit of clarification, further intense clarifications on this particular position. Especially that what the preferred nations work for. Also, there is an explanation, and then the rates that you apply to the tiles, how it works, to clarify exactly how it doesn't disenfranchise local investors. Because I guess you have raised at the end the same on skill benefits, but how? Just really require some clarification for.
Looking at our program for the fourth term, for the fourth quarter and the first quarter next year, fourth quarter this year, first quarter next year, we must maybe work in a workshop regarding all of these agreements. Government energy credit, what in real terms do we get? Will be quite interesting. Any other remarks from the members that we can conclude the meeting?
Mr. Chairman, I think that it would be appropriate if we visited each of these countries to discuss with them.
Yes, it can become a part of a strategic plan for 2040 going to 2019. It's a very interesting point you make. Also, the programs of the Development Bank of Southern Africa, where they are engaged in programs in Africa. But this is one of the committees in Parliament that we've got a tight program. So to go over the borders to other countries is quite a challenge to get out of the country. All the members, this brings us to the end of this part. Tomorrow morning it's appropriations, tomorrow afternoon we 2 o'clock we convene again for finance. And then we had the chairperson's meeting and the whips meeting last Wednesday afternoon after the local government summit, local government week. And it came from the chief whip that we were requested to be in Limpopo yesterday to do a review of the intervention in terms of section 102C of the Constitution. I addressed the meeting, and after the meeting, I addressed the meeting and told them why it was not possible to be in Limpopo yesterday. After the meeting, I met with the chief whip. The proposed dates for going to Limpopo. And before this meeting, I went back to the chief of the office to confirm again. The week of the 26th of August, that's a Monday, until Thursday the 29th. We might conclude the work before Thursday the 29th, because there's detailed preparations to be done, affecting a lot of people. I want you to diarize this, because we will be starting to do the preparations. It will be a joint visit, although the intervention has been referred to the Select Committee for Finance. But in terms of Rule 105 of the NSUP rules, that they ask us to do the work in consultation with the relevant committees, but we said we're doing it jointly, taking it a step further, and I already liaised to those chapters. I just want to share this information with the honourable members that you can do also your own planning. That will implicate that you go there the first week of the constituency period to be there as a full component of the relevant committees. And that was the arrangement with the chief whip, and she's satisfied. The people who made the public statements must turn to section 102C of the Constitution and procedures of Parliament. And that will be my comment if I'm being asked to comment on it. And going then back to the first letter I received from the chairperson of the NCP, Honorable Slangu, regarding the whole process of the intervention. Because that forms the basis of our committee's work, and that is factual. And I won't divert from that. Thank you, Honorable Members. That concludes the business of today. Mr. Colonel.
Thank you, Chair. So we are 2 o'clock tomorrow again?
Yes.
Thank you, sir.
2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
Yes.
This is fine. What is the order for us now?
It's 5 o'clock.
No. Your notice was circulated for 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. The reason bringing it forward is no plenaries.